Welcome to the business podcast of the American Chamber of Commerce in Australia. AmCham business podcasts are hosted by Dr. Duff Watkins. Duff is a director of Exec Search International, an author, and is also on the AmCham Council of Governors. AmCham, bringing business to you.
Hello and welcome to the podcast of the American Chamber of Commerce in Australia, where we take you behind the scenes to discover how business really works. Today we'll update you on the relationship between Australia and the U.S. Is it an alliance or a reliance? Are we true allies or just some sort of economically reliant relationship? Today you'll learn why Australia is getting so much attention in the U.S. Honestly, for decades, they couldn't find us on a map. Now you open a tabloid and we're on page one. What happened there? Today you'll learn why the U.S. is still the most important economic partner for Australia, and you'll see why, despite what you've read or despite what you've heard, the future is very bright for the Australia-U.S. relations. My name is Duff Watkins. I'm the host of the AmCham Business Podcast. Today, our guest is James Caruso, Chargé d'Affaires for the U.S. Embassy, and also the acting ambassador to Australia from the U.S. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Duff. Great to be here.
First question is, what is a Chargé d'Affaires?
You know, in the history of diplomacy, French was, for a long time, the language of diplomacy. English has pretty much overtaken it, except in a certain few instances, such as when an ambassador leaves, whoever takes their place is called chargé d'affaires, which is the exact same thing as acting ambassador.
Okay, that explains it. So basically, you want to bet. That's why you're the acting ambassador to Australia, because it's a great job.
I didn't have to whack anybody.
Okay. All right, well, let's get stuck into it. I know you spent 14 years in international investment and trade before you spent 22 years in the State Department. Lately, we've been pretty fortunate. Australia has had two U.S. vice presidents out here, one from different parties. Most recently, Vice President Pence visited in April. This month, the Prime Minister of Australia visited the President of the U.S. in the U.S., and next month, we've got two U.S. secretaries, Tillerson and Mattis, coming out to meet their counterparts. As we say in Australia, there's a lot of movement at the station. What's with all this activity and engagement? What does it mean?
You know, the U.S.-Australia alliance is based on something that's all too rare in the world, and that's trust. We trust each other to speak to each other honestly. We trust each other to work together. We trust each other on the battlefield and in business boardrooms, because while the cultures aren't the same, they're similar. So when Aussies go to the States, they have access at the highest level. Christopher Pyne was in Washington only a few weeks ago and met Secretary Mattis basically same day he asked for the meeting. Julie Bishop met with the Vice President, almost no problem. It's because our leadership knows when they talk to an Australian, they're going to get the unvarnished thoughts of that party. This is what Australia thinks. And the Australians we know come at these issues from the same place we do. Practical, how do we advance our common interests? And, you know, in our personal lives or in our professional lives, having someone who we know is going to tell us something straight and not have an ulterior agenda, that's pretty special.
I heard you say Australia is one of the few countries that can tell the U.S. to get stuffed and not really harm the relationship.
I think that's true. Again, it's because we know where it's coming from. It's not coming from a place where it's looking to take special advantage or just be up themselves. It's because this is what the Aussies think. And because we trust Australia to have actually pretty good judgment, even when we don't agree, at least we know it's coming from a place of trust and thought, and not just for some sort of political advantage of the moment or to make the interlocutor feel uneasy. It's a rare commodity, and we value it. And we know we value it because, as you said, we've had two vice presidents come out in the course of far less than a year, and we have all this interaction going on.
Well, okay. I know that you're aware of this because it's been in the newspapers. Business people talk about it. You can hear it. There are some people in Australia, business leaders, pundits, who are saying that Australia should turn away from the U.S. and look towards China for its economic future. That's something I never thought I would hear, but Well, you're hearing it more and more. Now, Foreign Minister Julie Bishop staunchly disagrees with this, and I think you do too. So my question is, what do you know that we don't?
Well, I think from the last time I left Australia in 2004 to the time I came back, China's rise has been remarkable. There's no doubt. 300 million people lifted to the middle class, 1.3 billion people overall, huge buyers of Australian commodities and some services. So, of course, when one country takes 30% of your exports, they take a lot of notice. But China's your customer. As Joe Hockey said, China's your customer, America's your business partner in Australia. We invest to help you produce the commodities that get sent to China. We work together to produce everything from 787 aircraft to joint strike fighters to modern pharmaceuticals. Partners do that. Customers are just customers. I don't understand why the alliance, which is basically irreplaceable for both of us, but you know, Australia would have to spend, according to former Ambassador Beasley, up to 5 or 6% of GDP to get the same modicum of protection as they get from the alliance. And that doesn't even include the intelligence relationship. So what's the option if there's no alliance for Australia? Is it neutrality? Is it spending this huge amount of GDP on self-defense? The idea that Australia is more effective in Southeast Asia or China by saying we're distant from the U.S., I don't think is correct. I don't see why it would give you more credibility. I think having your current policy of being independent of the U.S. on when we disagree, as we've seen on the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank or FONOPS in the South China Sea, shows your independent foreign policy in Australia. But behind that is an alliance that matters and that's effective.
You're quoting Joe Hockey, the Australian ambassador to the U.S., who points out China is a customer, the U.S. is a partner. And you would know, because this is your second stint in Australia, your first time here, you were helping negotiate the U.S.-Australia Free Trade Agreement, which many of us regard as a great success. Of course, you're on the U.S. team at that time, but it's been mutually beneficial. But let's continue with this China theme for a second. Okay, but China's economy is growing. Now, the U.S. economy is rebounding, it's recovering. And that's good, that's fine, it's still big. But yeah, you know, some people say, shouldn't Australia turn to China, look to China now? I mean, why not back a winner?
China is buying Australian goods and services regardless of the alliance. And in fact, China's not asking for any change in the alliance. What does Australia get in return for ditching the alliance? Are you going to sell more iron ore? Are you going to sell more natural gas? I don't see any difference. Chinese students are coming here regardless. Chinese tourists are coming here regardless. What is the advantage gained to Australia from ditching the alliance economically? I don't see it. You know, the U.S.-China economic relationship dwarfs the Australia-China relationship economically. And as you know, we have disagreements on certain things. But China is able to differentiate between disagreements and the economic relationship. And I would argue Australia is perfectly capable of walking and chewing gum.
President Trump has kind of made a career out of this America First agenda. It has been suggested that this Make America Great Again, this America First agenda, is a form of insulation leading to possible isolation. What's an average Australian citizen passport holder like me supposed to think of that?
Well, you know, when Vice President Pence was here, I think he put it pretty well. He said, it's America First, but not America only. And the idea is, actually echoes the recent budget here. It's fairness. The idea that the U.S. has the largest trade deficit in the world, in world history. And what President Trump has instructed all of us to look at is why. Is it because of normal patterns of trade? If so, that's not an issue. But if it's a matter of disadvantaging U.S. exports somehow, that should be looked at. And I know from my experience in countries elsewhere, there's a lot of barriers to trade against our exports that we don't have against the other countries' exports to the U.S. And President Trump is saying we're going to take a look at that because we're not going to be the market of last resort anymore.
So do you think he's insisting on a kind of fairness?
I think he is. And the way he seems to be defining fairness basically is if, again, not to pick on China, but China has a 25% tariff on imported automobiles from the U.S. We have a 5% tariff on China. So should we just say, oh, well, or are we going to do something about that? And China has achieved its remarkable economic success by dint of the hard work of the Chinese people and the openness of global economies, especially the U.S. But now China and other countries that have progressed because of the open trading system are going to have to abide by the rules applied equally.
And that's a good point, too, that fairness is a concept that needs to be interpreted on a regular basis. Jim, you were here in the early 2000s. You were helping to negotiate the Australia Free Trade Agreement. That was 13? How long ago?
2004.
So 13 years ago. Now you're at it again. How has the economic landscape changed in that time?
Well, certainly the biggest difference, of course, is e-commerce. And e-commerce was just starting out, really. And now, of course, it's a huge part of both our economies. So it's something we should think about. How do we think about e-commerce in terms of global trade? How do we get taxed? So with technology changing so fast, it's something that I think we always have to look at how we keep updating our agreements and our relationship to take account of new factors.
Do you have any sort of insights about what's the tax that's being bandied about now, the border tax?
Right, that's one in the U.S. And, of course, here is the income equalization tax, I think it's called, that basically taxes multinationals a different way. There's a recent tax finding against Chevron for the way they financed the big oil and gas project off the northwest corner of Australia. Again, tax. Thank God I'm not a tax lawyer. It's a constantly moving issue.
And emotional, too.
Oh, it
very
is.
Emotional.
Because, again, you know, it gets back to fairness stuff. You know, if Australians say it's unfair that Google sells a service here and the income from tax goes to some other country, not fair. And the U.S. says it's unfair that Apple sells all these products abroad, gets all the money, and keeps the money abroad so it can't get taxed in the U.S. So everyone is saying it's not fair, and as you said before, fairness sort of depends where you sit. But it's a good thing to discuss and remove uncertainty and barriers so that companies have clarity on what they should do. You know, companies tend to say, okay, if the tax is the tax, I'll live with it. I just want to know what the rule is. If there's a loophole, they're going to use that too.
You bet.
So let's not focus on fairness if we can help it. Let's focus on clarity, and if we can possibly do it, get the U.S. and Australia to sort of agree on some of the rules of the road.
You're an economics guy. You've been in it for a long time. You worked in so many countries, I couldn't even list them off because we don't have time. So how well do you think people understand tax, let alone things like transfer pricing and all the things that are very important to international, multinational businesses?
Well, you know, it's a real disadvantage for SMEs that these things are so complicated, because then they have to hire the advice of tax lawyers and accountants, and it's an expensive process. It'd be really nice if it was really clear in a 15-page booklet about all these things, but we're not there. But I feel very strongly that SMEs employ more people than multinationals in both our countries. We should help our SMEs take advantage of things like trade agreements rather than making it confusing.
And an SME, a small, medium enterprise, it comprises the bulk of the economy. There are more SMEs in the business, both in the U.S. and Australia, and probably in most countries. And therefore, they employ more people than the big companies. But of course, the big companies get all the press because they have certain resources, and they do certain things to make certain kinds of contributions that smaller companies cannot make. Where to from here? Where do you see the next stage being in the U.S.-Australian relationship?
I think on the business and economic side, there's all sorts of opportunity. Because we have the same belief in rule of law, transparency, anti-corruption, it's one reason we're the biggest investor here, and Australia's largest destination for investments in the U.S. We pretty much know the rules in each other's countries. But we can make it better, and we can make it better by having an updated tax treaty. There's a huge opportunity. Both our leaderships talk about infrastructure, having new infrastructure, investing infrastructure. Well, how about we work on that together? How about we compare best practices? How about we look at how we can raise capital together? Maybe your companies have certain skill sets and ours. Maybe we work together to have the best possible infrastructure, bang for the buck what the taxpayer is paying for.
You're pretty optimistic about the relationship, which I'm very glad to hear, by the way. That's very encouraging. But, okay, let's do, instead of Australia telling the U.S. to get stuff, let's have some straight talk from you. You've been in Australia a couple times. You've been around the world. You've been to a lot of markets. What sort of things do you think Australia or Australians need to hear in order to, for us, speaking as an Australian now, to lift our game, to take our game to the next level?
You know, I've led AmCham business delegations to Darwin and LA. Next week I'm going to Perth. And it's great because this gives a chance for our companies to see maybe parts of Australia they haven't seen and meet the leaderships in those places, and especially the entrepreneurs and accelerators and incubators. And what we hear over and over again is the difference in business culture is Americans aren't as afraid to fail as Australians are. And whatever the cultural difference is, that's what I'm told is the number one single issue. Not access to capital, not good ideas, not skill sets. It's just willingness to go out and have a go. And if you fail, you pick yourself up and you start over again. And it's interesting to me because given Australia's commodity culture and the high risk of failure, whether you're a miner or a farmer, it's surprising to me that that hasn't translated into the tech sector as much. But I think it's starting. I love going to all these tech centers here and seeing these kids thinking big ideas. It's a blast.
You think it's sort of a cultural cautiousness or conservatism when it comes to, which, by the way, I've seen replicated in the corporate circles as well. It often surprises me how timid some of these corporate execs are. Easy for me to say, by the way. It's not my money. I'm the guy sitting here talking to you.
The culture in the U.S. is apparently more appetite for risk. And I think part of that is because there's perceived to be less drama if you fail. And in fact, you know, in Silicon Valley, when you talk to a venture capitalist, they'll ask someone, how many times have you failed already? And if you said several, that's a plus.
It's a rite of passage.
It is. It's a rite of passage. They say, well, you've learned something. Where apparently in Australia, if you failed once, the bank says, well, I'm writing you off. And it's that's the biggest thing.
What do you reckon are the global challenges which Australia and the U.S. could or should face together?
Well, there's several. Again, in the business sense, there is certainly an anti-globalization sentiment out there. And part of this is just, as we discussed, technological change is so rapid that people feel left behind. And so let's take autonomous vehicles, self-driving vehicles as an example. So if you're driving a taxi or a truck and you see that 10 years' time, you may not have a job because Uber is driving itself, what do you do? And it's a challenge for our societies and our governments to think about, how do we take care of these people who are now unemployed through no fault of their own? How do we upskill them? How do we give them ability to earn a living? And I say society because it's clearly something that we've encouraged truck drivers in both our countries because we need truck drivers. Now we don't need truck drivers. What do we do with these people?
It's very true. Technology changes much faster than humans do. And another good example is the health system. The technology can change rapidly, but the health system itself is fixed and takes a long time to change. As same with political processes, as you would well know. We've talked a bit about innovation, or we've touched upon innovation. How does the U.S.-Australia alliance affect innovation, if it does at all?
I think the biggest aspect of that is the fact that our businesses feel comfortable doing business in each other's countries. So you see Boeing having an R&D center here in Lockheed. You see a landing pad for the Australian government in San Francisco, and CSIRO having an operation, I think, in Silicon Valley someplace. And executives going back and forth like nothing. And, you know, anytime you get to share DNA that way, usually good things come out of it. I think that's by far the biggest advantage we have in working with each other.
You're on your second stint here, and your first is acting ambassador to Australia. Any surprises that have come your way, positive or negative?
I was really pleased in Canberra that the restaurant scene has gotten much, much better.
Signs of civilization.
Oh, it was such a relief. What I have seen, honestly, is that Australia has become more outward-looking. I know it's a process over decades, but after not having been here for 13 years, I could really see that Australia has said, yeah, we are dealing with not just Europe or the UK even, or not just the west coast of the US. Australia has become a global competitor, which is great.
Jim, just getting back to the America First agenda, does America still welcome traders, investors, business people from other countries like little old Australia?
They absolutely do, Duff. Just as one example, every year we have something called Select USA, which is a huge conference in Washington where we welcome potential investors from all over the world. They have meetings with very high-level government officials, potential business partners, and the idea is how we do matchmaking at the highest level. And we have a really strong delegation coming from Australia this year, which is great.
And that's to expedite doing business in the U.S.
That's correct.
The whole function.
That's correct. That's the only reason is to get investors into the U.S.
Select USA.
Select USA. Austrade has all sorts of offices in the U.S., and they work with our Department of Commerce to help our export-import industries work with each other, and we welcome that. You know, Duff, there's also been a lot of discussion lately that with the crackdown on migration and immigration in the U.S., that visitors to the U.S. are less welcome. And you hear the occasional story in the press about someone being called over for further interviews by our immigration service. Mm-hmm. I looked into this. I had my staff call up the stats, and there are no more people being pulled into what they call secondary for further interview than there were this time last year or the year before. It's really constant. And usually it's people who have reason to have caused some suspicion. Occasionally it's an overzealous immigration official, for sure. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Australia, the U.S. is still, I think, the third largest destination for Australian tourists. And of the hundreds of thousands that go, pretty much a handful that have problems. And it's terrible that they have any problems at all. And we're encouraging our officials to be even more diligent in making sure they're not calling people out unnecessarily. But Australians are amazingly welcome. I'm in my next life, I'm coming back as an Australian in the U.S. because all I have to do is open my mouth and people just want to talk to me and hug me and give me a biscuit. So it's really sad, actually.
Yes, well, but it could be worse. So what do you reckon is the basis of this long-running, a century plus, a long-running, long-standing, pretty deep relationship between the two countries, the two cultures? Doesn't matter what the governments are. I mean, you know, as you know, politicians, diplomats, state people, they come and go, but whoever is filling the slots, that relationship just seems to endure.
It's true. Now, again, the cultures are not the same, but the cultures are similar enough that we can look at the other and say, oh, I get it, more often than not. And again, from 99 years ago when General Monash led American troops on July 4th, 1918 in the Battle of Hamel, to today where the deputy commander of PACOM is an Aussie, commanding American Army troops in the Pacific, it's that sort of interaction which is so intense and deep that it can't be replicated. And as you said, it doesn't matter who's in the White House or the Lodge, those personal relationships and business relationships and cultural relationships are so deep and broad, the rest doesn't matter. We'll have disagreements from time to time, mainly at the political level. Certainly, when you look back at our history, you had everything from September 11th, when John Howard was in Washington and said, we stand by America, to World War II, where Menzies said, we stand with America, to Iraq, when despite the debate in both our countries about it, the Aussies sent troops there as well. It's not to say we're joined at the hip. It's that we can talk to each other and understand each other and more often than not give each other the benefit of the doubt, even while telling each other to get stuffed when we have to.
And that's how you sustain a relationship between two countries for one century and probably another century as well. We'll finish on that note. You've been listening to the AmCham Business Podcast. Our guest today has been Jim Caruso, Acting Ambassador from the U.S. to Australia. And you can find out more about Select USA at the website, selectusa.gov. In fact, you can cover all the trade issues at this website, au.usembassy.gov. In fact, you can talk to us by email, podcast@amcham.com.au. But we want to know what you want to know. What are the topics, the people, the issues that are of interest to you? In fact, you can hear all the podcasts at the website, amcham.com.au. This is AmCham bringing business to you. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the business podcast of the American Chamber of Commerce in Australia. AmCham has an extensive list of live events throughout Australia. To learn more about our event program and learn how you can access even more opportunities through membership, please visit our website at amcham.com.au. AmCham, bringing business to you.
Hi, this is Duff Watkins. I'm a governor of the American Chamber of Commerce in Australia. People ask me, what are the benefits of joining AmCham? Well, it comes down to this. Nothing gets bought or sold until you deal with another person. You have to meet people in business. Business is all about trust and interaction. The best place I know to meet people, business people, your kind of people, customers, potential customers, is at AmCham. That's why I've been a member for 27 years. You can find out more about AmCham on the website, amcham.com.au.